Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hear my words and bear witness to my vow. Night gathers and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the shield that guards the realm of men. I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch. For this night, and all the nights to come.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Game of Thrones. I'm Vanity Fair Senior Writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair Chief Critic Richard Lawson.
We are here today to talk about Season 8, Episode 2 of Game of Thrones, titled A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, written by Brian Cogman and directed by David Nutter. If you were just joining us, we spent the last part of the off-season talking about our favorite episodes of Game of Thrones. And I gotta say, if we were gonna do it again, this episode would probably land in that mix for me. I really, really loved it. Richard, what did you think of this episode of Game of Thrones?
I think barring one slightly major misstep, I really liked it a lot too.
Excellent. We will talk about that. We should say now that we're in the actual season, something that we weren't able to do before the season started because we were pre-recording, our schedule was all over the place. But now that we're back to a week-to-week schedule, if you guys want to email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, and we're not talking about Podrick Payne, so stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, you can email us your thoughts on Game of Thrones, your questions that you want us to answer, all that sort of thing. We'll promise to try to get to some of those in the episode. We're going to discuss the episode more broadly and then get into an interview that we have with writer and co-executive producer Brian Cogman, his third time on this show because he's just the best.
He's our Amy Sedaris or something, like our Letterman or something.
I just really think he's the greatest, so we're so glad to have him back. But first, we wanted to hand out a few awards for the episode. Usually, I do a 15-word recap. I don't know that it's super necessary for these episodes that we're all watching together, but for this one, I just came up with, like, people in rooms talking. I think that really...
That's pretty good, yeah.
I guess you could say, like, people in rooms, courtyards, crypts, ramparts, talking. So, you know, there we go. And then we wanted to hand out an obvious MVP. Richard, who's your obvious MVP for this episode?
Well, I think I did this last week too, but I still gotta go with Bran. I think this whole, like, omniscience, you know, like, almost self-sacrificing, but like without any sort of emotion thing, like really puts him in a position of power above all else at Winterfell at the moment.
I love that. All right. I have some interesting, that's my own opinion. Maybe interesting brand thoughts to talk about. My obvious MVPs for this episode is tie between Gwendolyn Christie and Nikolai Coster-Waldau, who play Bran of Tarth and Jaime Lannister, respectively. These are two characters that I love together so much, and the plot has sort of kept them apart for seasons and seasons and seasons. Having them back together, I feel like you can tell that the actors, that their favorite stuff to do is this stuff as well. Honestly, I think you see them alive in a way that you don't see them alive elsewhere. So, there's that sneaky MVP of the episode. Richard, who do you have?
Well, you said when you were giving out the email address that we're not referring to Podrick Payne. So it made me change my sneaky MVP to Podrick Payne, because look at him looking good, fighting good, as his surrogate parents of a sort, Jamie and Brienne, watch on in, you know, respectful admiration. I think that Pod showed up quite well in this episode.
And singing like a little champ at the end.
Of course, yes, right.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so funny when that scene started, and I was like, I didn't know that there was going to be a song in this episode, but the scene starts with like, shall we have a song? I was like, someone's going to sing. And then, like, before they even went through the list, I, like, got a little misty-eyed because I was like, oh my god, is it going to be Pod? And it was, and he was, Daniel Portman just sounded so beautiful. My sneaky MVP is Ghost, because even though he's in this episode, you would be forgiven if you missed him in this episode. He's just sort of standing there, without moving, really, it seemed like, in this sort of rampart scene. Between the Night's Watch boys, Sam and Ed and John, he's just sort of there. And that, you know, people were really missing him last week's episode. He didn't like go bounding out into the courtyard to greet John when he returned. So they were like, you want some ghosts? Here's some ghosts. He's here. We swear. And he is there. So we get credit for ghosts being there.
Well, true to his name, I did not see him.
All right, we're going to do a quote or favorite quote from the episode. This is a funny one because, like, last week I feel like there was an embarrassment of riches because it was a very, like, quippy episode. This week wasn't very quippy. It was more sincere, and those are harder quotes to sort of pluck out because at this point we kind of like to, you know, often like to pick something kind of silly. But I have to go with my heart here and say, "Arise, Sir Brienne, a knight of the Seven Kingdoms," is like the quote of the episode. Richard, do you have anything?
Well, I was going to try to do Tormund Giantsbane talking about sucking from giant teats or whatever.
But right.
I didn't want to put myself or you or the audience through that. So yeah, I'm going to agree. I mean, that's "Arise, you know, a knight" is the quote of the episode and the emotional crux of the episode.
Yeah. Then we want to hand out really quickly a little best dressed award. I can't pick anyone other than Sansa Stark, who is wearing like strips of leather riveted to themselves and each other as a sort of like breastplate, austere black Lady of Winterfell, don't fuck with me Daenerys dress. What do you pick best dressed this episode?
Well, I think that all the ladies, well, not all, but almost all are doing sort of variations on a theme. And I don't know, for whatever reason, Miss Sandy's, particular, like, winter look struck out to me, or stuck out to me last night. I don't know, there was just something really, I like the warm weather people in cold weather climate and see how they adapt, and they're adapting well.
It's a very, her look is a very fashion forward look, because mm-hmm. you would think if you were in the snow all the time, you would choose just like, function, but her like beautiful, like warm looking winter dress has this like big hole cut out of the back, not all the way through to her skin, but like the warm part has a big hole in it. And I'm like, for me, I would want to have like, you know, my shoulder blades warmer, but you know, Miss Andy's like, make it fashion, make these racist northerners know how beautiful I look. So yeah.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo. Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
And then we do a ship of the episode, two characters that we are rooting or inanimate objects that we are rooting for to be together. I usually pick something silly for this, but I got to go once again with sincerity and pick Jamie and Bran, who are my like ultimate ship of the entire series. Richard, which two crazy kids or things are you rooting for to get together?
I'm going to go half what you went. I'm going to say Brienne, but I'm not going to ship her with like any fate other than the inevitable death she's going to suffer next week, I think.
Yes, this is something we should talk about more broadly as we talk about this episode, because this is a, you know, being touted as like a calm before the storm, theatrical people talking in rooms, character-based episode, and it is all of those things. And I think it is in my like softest heart imaginings, I imagine that this is the showrunners Weiss and Benioff giving Brian Cogman one last platform to do what he does best, which is these people talking in rooms episodes. But then you have to like put on your podcast about the series hat and also examine it from the angle of they're trying really hard to make us care about these characters before they kill them all brutally next week, which is an unavoidable thought to have, I think. And like my death pool, I don't know who dies next week. I have some ideas. But, you know, my death pool definitely shifted based on who we got to spend the most time with in this episode and who had the tenderest sort of, you know, the person who had the tenderest stuff in this episode, be worried about them perhaps next week. I don't know about Jamie and Brienne, but I would not fault anyone for putting them at like the very top of their list.
Well,
one of them, right?
Yeah, let's run through it. So either Jamie and Brienne, I would say Brienne. Grey Worm for sure, right? Like the way that they were, I feel like they were indicating that. Like when
I would say, I would say to Noth, I would say Grey Worm or Miss Sandy, like one of them, right? You know what I mean? You don't get to say, you don't get to like paraphrase. There's a place for us and survive. Yeah,
exactly. Totally.
Survive.
Oh my god, that's exactly what it was. It's like a little, like very, very like embedded tease for Steven Spielberg's West Side Story.
Theon and Sansa. I would say Theon. Right.
Yeah, that's gonna happen. Yeah.
I mean that feels to me the most inevitable end of this episode is that Theon Greyjoy has come home to Winterfell to die. Protecting Bran, like reuniting with Sansa, all of that. Jorah Mormont's high on my list. He got a Valyrian steel sword. Mm-hmm, you know, he did all the things. He's guts to go.
Beric is probably not long for this world again.
Beric and or the Hound. And then maybe Gendry. But I feel like Game of Thrones is not going to do this thing where like these characters, like the horror movie thing of these characters had sex. Now one of them's going to die. I feel like it's not going to do that, but I could be wrong. But,
That feels less like a, less like they were indicating toward an inevitable death than some other scenes, I think.
Yeah. And then Pod. Pod's really on my list too, I gotta say. Pod and Dolores Ed. Ed, who is like Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, is crazy that he's still alive. Also Tormund, also Davos. Basically all your faves. Basically my philosophy is this, or my theory is this. What we're gonna see next week is Game of Thrones, and once again, I don't know, this is not spoilery. Game of Thrones is gonna kneecap the B string of its cast. They've got a whole roster of B-level characters that we care a good deal about, and they can take them all or almost all out next week and still have plenty of cast to make it through to the end of the season. And then they're going to drop at least one A-string player. And I think that's Theon Greyjoy. So,
yeah, I mean, it's funny, like, the episode just, like, beat for beat reminded me so much of, like, the final episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, like, the season 7 series finale. Like, these conversations at night before the big scary thing happens, you know, it just, this sense of, like, everyone's together kind of reflecting, like, I'm making a very favorable comparison. I think that's a great episode. But then you think about, maybe it's the episode before, I don't remember how the season, the end of Buffy was structured, maybe it was two episodes, but regardless, what happened next was, I mean, spoiler alert for something that happened 15 years ago, but, you know, a B player died in Anya, but it still really felt like,
ooh, it hurt. It,
oh God, I hate that death. I mean, I understand why they did it. And then an A player died in Spike, and it really, you know, as a kind of big self-sacrifice. So, even though they brought him back in Angel or whatever, but, you know, so I feel like if we're kind of following that Buffy model, I think you're absolutely right that, like, you know, maybe it won't just be one Anya, it'll be several because there are more characters to work with, but, like, next episode has to give us at least one major character death. And yeah, Theon seems right primed for that.
So you're saying that, this episode was the equivalent of, like, Anya and Andrew chair racing,
That's exactly right.
The end of Buffy. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So I saw your tweet last night where you're like, Anya dies in a hallway in this, right? And I was like, yep. So, okay. But that's next week. And that's not really, I guess, you know, the point of this is if all these people are going to die tomorrow, this is a beautiful, like, love letter farewell to them. And I think in that respect, it works. So, well, I had high hopes for this because I like Brian's episodes historically, and I'm not just saying that because he's on this podcast. I like them historically. I knew that this was a Calm Before the Storm episode. I knew it was going to be a lot of people talking rooms, which is, like, extremely my shit. And so, my expectations were probably a little too high going into this episode. And then I gotta say, for me, this episode didn't let me down. The Jamie and Bran stuff and like, it's not just the Jamie and Bran stuff. It's like the other people who are in that room as well. The witnesses of everything that happened there felt like a tremendously earned payoff. When I was writing about the Jamie and Bran relationship yesterday for VF.com, I was like, let me look up the date of their first episode together. Like, when did that air? How long have I been, like, thinking about this? And maybe I wasn't thinking about it from their very first episode when, like, she shows up and he's like, is that even a woman or whatever? Like, but it was May 2012. So that's like 7 years we've been with these characters, which is crazy to think about. Crazy to think about how much has changed in our world and, like, for us personally, like, since this narrative started, but to see it come to, like, such a, really emotional. And, like, honestly, it felt so earned to me. The Jamie Brienne stuff felt super earned to me. And honestly, actually, the Theon and Sansa stuff felt really earned to me. So, you know, and all these little grace notes, all these little callbacks, and, like, a scene would start and, like the Davos and Gilly thing with that little girl. And, like, it started and I was like, oh no, it's a Shireen callback. Oh my God. So, like, I don't know. I was the definition of that, like, that gif of that kid at some sporting event, I don't know what it is, where he's just, like, basically crying and going, like, oh my God, that was me in this episode. And I feel like I don't usually get that with TV shows because I am constantly, like, trying to analyze and think and critically, and I don't let myself get emotionally invested as much anymore, you know, because it's, like, my job to sort of not be emotionally invested. And especially in Thrones, I've had so much trouble being emotionally invested of late because everything felt like it was on fast forward. So to have this pause meant a good deal to me as a way to say goodbye to a lot of characters and themes that are important to me. Richard, do you want to talk to me about what you liked on this episode before we hit that thing that you thought was a little rougher, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, hats off to not only the people who make the show, Weiss and Benioff, your best friend, Brian Cogman, but also HBO in a way, because it's like, I mean, I guess they were going to let these people end the show however they wanted in some senses, but, like, this is now two episodes into a highly anticipated final season where, like, stuff has happened, sure, but, like, it hasn't been terribly violent. There haven't been big action scenes. I mean, that's over 2 hours of almost over 2 hours of content where, like, of a only six episode season. And I think it's, you know, really respectable that they're letting them take their time, like build up to this. I know next week is going to be this insane 50 days of night shoots, you know, battle.
Right, right.
You know, Royale. And that's going to be, you know, the payoff. But, you know, I saw someone on Twitter last night compare this, like they were like, so this really is all just going to, like, it feels so far like this final season might just be one long episode that's just structured in like acts, which I think is an interesting way to think about things. So yeah, I like all that. I think the conversation was good. I think that, you know, Game of Thrones can sometimes be a little too cute or on the nose when it tries to have this kind of sense of esprit de corps or bonhomie or sort of reminding us of who relates to who and how. But I think they got the emotional tenor just right in so many crucial scenes, that yeah, it was this kind of like, what a long, strange trip it's been, you know, like looking back and oh, how improbable that all these characters would be here together. But then they had the characters comment on that, like Tyrion saying, I wish, you know, our father was here so he could see that his two sons are going to die protecting Winterfell tomorrow. So all that was great, I thought, you know. The thing that clanged to me,
yeah,
no pun intended, now that I think about it, it was the Gendry and Arya thing. I felt, you know, I don't want to deny a character like Arya a sort of sexual, you know, life, a sort of at that aspect to her being. But I just didn't really think that, given all that Arya's been through, we had sort of seen her to that point, you know? Like, I just saw a couple of people reacting to the show last night who were just like, you know, much in the same way the show hasn't quite really processed Sansa's rape and like what that, you know, the effects of that. I think they've tried to do that with her. They haven't really had Arya work through, like, I mean, she was abused, but in many senses by, you know, many different people. And, I don't know that her sort of seducing Gendry to have like one, you know, roll in the hay before they all meet their maker. Like, I don't know that felt like a big leap for that character in a way that I didn't quite track.
It's so interesting because I think what makes that all work for me is that last shot when they're montaging over Pod singing and you see Arya in bed with Gendry and she's mm-hmm. not, or in the like bales of hay with Gendry or whatever. And she's not like, yeah, this was great. It was very like end of The Graduate for me. You know what I mean? Where it's just sure. sort of like, I made that choice. Now what? Or, you know, what is, maybe that didn't do exactly what I was expecting it would do in this like last night on Earth thing. My impression of Arya and of a lot of characters is I have two different working theories about what it means in this season to return to Winterfell. For all the members of the Stark family, and I include Jon and Theon in that, it's about returning to like their Starkish identity. Like, I feel like you see as they're all around each other, even Bran, to a certain extent, I think you see them sort of relaxing back into their own humanity. They had to like, they went through all this crazy shit, all this abuse, all these awful things happened to them, and they threw up all these walls because of course they have to, in order to survive. And I include Sansa in this, obviously. And then they're back in Winterfell and you start to see those walls come down as they're around the people that they do inherently trust, you know? And so I feel like what I think they're going for, and sometimes it works for me and sometimes it doesn't, with Arya is that she like became this inhuman, like Terminator robot killing machine, which is just not fun or compelling to watch on TV, I think. And is slowly sort of reheating her humanity as she's back in Winterfell, as she's back around her friends. And she's still a little bit like, what are your strange human ways? You know what I mean? Like, I don't understand you earthlings about it. But that she's like working on it. And that was sort of my interpretation of this, is like, she's like, oh, this is what humans do. I'm going to do it. You know what I mean? And like, that's sort of how I felt about it. But I didn't feel like it was an ordinary, let's just have a roll in the hay, interaction between two characters. Does that distinction make sense?
No, it does make sense. And I think, you know, Arya has since the first season always been a character who is eager for the next thing, for the next challenge or the next kind of, I guess, milestone on the way to adulthood. You know, she always kind of, she resented being young and being a girl, I guess, too, also, which is, part of the equation for her. So yeah, I can see it from a lot of different angles where it totally works. And, you know, I think there is definitely part of me that's just like, oh, I've seen her since she was a little kid. Like, I don't want, you know, like, it's very strange to have that sort of my conception of this character. And in some senses, that actress, like, be sort of, you know, like, oh, well, she grew up, you know, whatever. I don't want to be like all like, you know, sex shamey or whatever about it. And I'm not even really coming at it from that place. It's more that just, I don't know. It just felt sort of abrupt for her in a way, but I guess that character has always done things a bit, you know, rashly. I don't know if it was rash exactly. I mean, she's known him for a long time. Like, whatever. Like, I don't know. I guess I'm sort of tying myself up in knots about it for no reason.
Well, I mean, I will say I wrote about it a bit last night. The show has always had this slightly weird challenge, which is the fact that, like, not only did they, age up the characters when they cast them, like all the kid characters were aged up when they did the show, right? So in the books, you know, like Arya and Sansa, Jon and all the Lannister kids and Daenerys are all like several years younger than their actor counterparts were on the screen. And that saved us a lot of trauma from watching like tiny, tiny people, not to mention like bad kid actors, execute certain things. Right. But at the same time, then there were occasional gaps in the adaptation. And I'm thinking specifically of like, let's say someone like Sansa. Sansa is a character that I always liked and liked even more this last time we went through the season. I really, really warmed to her. And I thought Sophie Turner, incidentally, was great in this episode. But that character is so much younger in the books. And so when you have early season Sansa, who's like so naive and so petulant, like when that character is so much younger, you're like, okay. Or Rob, like Rob's so much younger, so he sleeps with Talisa and brings about the Red Wedding, but he's like a teen. So you're like, okay. You know what I mean? Like it's a little different. And so they've always had this weird gap of that. And then as the show progresses, these kid actors have grown up. And so like, no matter how time is passing on the show, you can't deny that these actors, like, you know, bodies, not to put it too crude a point on it, are like older, you know what I mean? And so like Arya is still a kid on the page. She's still like, 11 or something like that. I think George R. R. Martin said, but like, you know, Maisie Williams is in her 20s. So with Arya, that's a long way around to say that Arya, like, she has one moment in season 3, I think it is season 2 maybe, where she's like, basically, I fucking Gendry. This is a famous shot, at least for those of us who make Game of Thrones gifs, of like, the, you know, poor Joe Dempsey. I think when he was talking to me on the podcast, he was like, yeah, the makeup ladies like use some soot to give me some abs, or whatever. But like the camera pans up him as like Arya has like some hardcore female gaze moment when she's like quite young. And then they just like press pause on that. For years, like, you got none of that from Arya until Gendry came back. And that feels unrealistic. And then, like, with Sansa, it's, you know, it's a trickier territory. It's hard to say. Like, she went from having a crush on gay Loras to starting to understand her sexual power over Littlefinger. And then this thing with Ramsay happened that I'm just like, I don't really even want to talk about Sansa and her sexual identity after that. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, she can do that at her own pace, and I am not having any opinions about that, you know. So like, that's a long ramble, but I just sort of feel like there's been, I agree, especially with like the Stark girls, there's been this weird gap between, the kids on the page and the actual young women they are. And I was actually glad this existed, because I was afraid that, like, you know, like John gets multiple girlfriends and his sisters get like nothing fun to do, like, right. It's, yeah. You know,
and maybe that's in some ways what I'm reacting to almost subconsciously. It's like, it's so fucking rare on this show for a woman to have a positive sexual experience, that like I'm like, whoa, weird, you know, that's out of tune, you know. And it's like, well, maybe it shouldn't be. You know, like, this is, yeah. That's a major way that this show has been seriously lopsided since the beginning. So yeah, I don't know. I guess my feelings about that scene were I was surprised that they kind of went there, in the old, Degrassi, parents. But, you know, I think it's good in the end that, maybe we have a sort of more grown up understanding of Arya, because, you know, I think both the character and Maisie Williams' wonderful performance have earned that.
Someone pointed out, and I thought that was really, I kind of missed the whole kickback on Twitter about this because I was like working. I just saw like people were saying that people were upset that Arya had sex. And I know that if they were, it was probably not for the same reasons you just articulated, which were very nuanced. I think a lot of people, I don't know if you saw that Google search spike, but a lot of people Googled like, how old is Maisie Williams sort of thing? Like, right when the episode aired, cause they're like, I'm sorry, what? Cause she, you know, Maisie Williams is a, like a diminutive person. So she just like looks younger than she is. We grew up with her, blah, blah, blah. But that's, that in and of itself is, I think, a good boundary to push. It's like, yeah, your your daughters grow up to be sexual beings. Get used to it, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's right and okay to be unsettled a bit by that scene for whatever reason. I don't think you, to me, it didn't read as, just wholly like, fuck yeah, Arya's getting her rocks off. Cause there's just like something, there's just something else. Yeah, especially their courtship involves like her throwing daggers. You know, there's always just something like off with Arya. Yeah. That's the sort of thing, you know.
So many of her rites of passage have been necessitated or sort of created by violence or, you know, or in reaction to violence or something, you know, impending death or whatever. Like she's not been able, not, I mean, not like, not like anybody on the show really has been able to, but like, you know, John got a sort of peaceful romp in a, you know, sexy water cave or whatever. Like,
right.
And Arya gets it, like, she's like, okay, I'm gonna lose my virginity, like, right before, you know, the army of the undead comes crashing through the walls of my family home. So yeah, the circumstances for her have always been pretty dire.
Yeah, it really bothered me when people are like, she didn't have time in those years to like have a crush. I was like, John fought many battles, came back from the dead, and still nailed two eligible ladies.
So, still figured out like, what cunnilingus was like, while journeying.
On the fly.
Like, yeah. North of the wall. You know?
It's true. So anyway, yeah, I think it's a good thing to have a conversation about. Someone I know on Twitter, and I can't remember who it was, did mention that she thought that there was a think piece somewhere in this idea that we had like no issue with Arya like genociding an entire house last season or killing all these people. Like that's something that just sort of, but like the, when she becomes this like sexual being, that's when there's like a major pushback in terms of like, she's so young. She's, that's not your argument, I know, but just like a general argument of like, but she's just a kid. What is this? You know, this idea of like this dichotomy of sex and violence and what feels okay and what doesn't, and especially what feels okay for women to do and what doesn't.
You know? Well, yeah. I mean, if we want to unpack, you know, our culture's really fraught, relationship with concepts of violence and sex. I mean, we could do that, but people are going to be listening to this for about the next 6 days.
It's going to need a minute. All right. Let's talk about this, Jamie and Brienne, or maybe more specifically, Jamie's, like, Jamie arrives at Winterfell, goes on trial, basically, briefly, has a chat with Bran, has a chat with his brother, and then, you know, has this, you know, empty chairs and empty tables or whatever you want to call it, moment with all these fellas and Bran before they go to war. Like, I don't know, this felt like such an important and, you know, I felt like thoughtful pause for this character. What did you think of Jamie, like, coming home to Winterfell or coming back to Winterfell?
I thought it was good. I think it was a great, showcase for Coster Waldo, like, you know, to do some, you know, a sort of quieter take on the character or sort of more like forlorn and weary, than I guess we're used to seeing, at least from early season, Jamie. You know, I thought also the conversation between him and Tyrion, and I know that Cersei's still looming in the South, you know, I know that she's still present, but in some senses, but like just the two of them sitting there and like this whole House Lannister and all of its sort of mighty trappings and, you know, it's been decimated by, well, dragons, yes, but like also, just greed and hubris and all this stuff. And just to have this whole thing just reduced to these two like weary middle-aged guys sitting in a room that, you know, in a house that's not theirs. Like, I thought that was like a pretty, no matter what happens to Jaime or Tyrion in the next few episodes, like a pretty, I don't know, poignant end to the Lannister narrative in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that has, you know, and I wrote about this a bit last night, but like something that I've thought about for a long time is the fact that Jamie's narrative and Bran's narrative were really impacted by the fact that the show decided to not do Lady Stoneheart. The decision to not do Lady Stoneheart, which is the resurrection of Catelyn Stark, not only deprived all of us of Michelle Fairley doing a zombie thing for several seasons, which is fine, whatever, I get it. But Jaime and Brienne's story is so tied to hers in the book, you know, because they swore this vow to Catelyn, and then just sort of their plot after they both leave King's Landing is like has them in the Riverlands and tied to Catelyn, and there's this like big
someone
lady
eats Brienne's face or something. Is that like a thing that happens? Some person attacks her outside of a pub or something. I don't remember, but an inn.
Yeah, there's some biting and stuff like that that happens generally. But like, but when you remove Lady Stoneheart from that, then you don't have anything really substantive for Jaime and Brienne to do in the Riverlands. And so they tried to like come up with some other things for them to do. So like they sent Brienne up north. And so she hung around there for a while and she got some things to do. She got to kill Stannis, like that happened, you know, but like mostly she's just been like stalwart and by Sansa's side for, she's been like, I will say like seasons 2 through 4, Brienne becomes like a protagonist, her own character, an A-lister. And then she got slotted back into a sidekick role in a way, that was hard at times for me to watch. I'm like, they don't have a thing for a Brienne to do. So, you know, as Gwendolyn put it at a Comic-Con panel one year, like, she just sat and stared at a candle in a window for several months. Like, that's something that they didn't know what to do with Brienne. And then similarly, Jaime, like, in the books, Jaime leaves Cersei super early, like, pretty, you know, like, and, like, goes to Riverlands, like, breaks up with her for good. I think, you know, who knows, but like, and is done with her. He never goes to Dorne. He doesn't like hang around her as she gets like increasingly unhinged season after season. And like what that did is it really like, stymied Jaime's arc. You know what I mean? Because like he was just like orbiting Cersei, instead of like on the road to independence, which is what is started when he leaves her and goes on the road with Brienne and stuff like that. It's like him breaking free from her. And so they just like basically put these two characters on hold because they cut their plot out, and they're both great. Like Gwendolyn Christie's great. Nicola Coster-Waldau's great. They did like, I think the very best of what they were given, but it really feels like their narrative, they pressed pause since like season 4 and now they're back, you know, on their arc, which includes each other. And I don't mean that just as like a moony-eyed like shipper or whatever. Like it just, it matters that they're together for their mutual character enrichment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I think you're right that they, you know, they were out in at sea a bit. But whatever sort of momentum they lost or whatever sort of prominence in the kind of viewer's imagination, I feel like they've gained it back really quickly, which is, you know, which is a testament to really good writing and perform, you know, acting.
Awesome. Okay, thank you for letting me monologue about that. The last thing that I wanted to talk about before we hop over to our interview is the Sansa and Theon stuff, which like I knew that Theon was coming back to Winterfell. I for some reason expected his return would be so tied up with Bran and all the wrongs that he did to Bran that I didn't even have the Sansa thing on my radar, even though of course like they had this huge bonding storyline in season 5 and the beginning of season 6. I was very taken by surprise by how much it mattered to me that these two have this connection in this episode. What did you think of the Sansa and Theon stuff?
I mean, I thought it was nice. I thought, in some senses, I didn't know if I fully bought the big hug, you know? But no, it was nice. And like, I, you know, they're like OG characters and so to see them sort of find one another, I think is good and it feels right to some extent. But I guess if this episode was kind of setting up various like pairings where one is going to die next week, this felt maybe a little bit manipulative sort of somehow. But I don't know. I'm so like pro Sansa and weirdly pro Theon that like any sort of criticism of their little mini arc in this season, I'm sort of immune to.
Yeah. I mean, like, to be honest, they had, I mean, like said basically, he said basically one sentence to her, and then the rest is like looks and montage, you know what I mean?
Right.
So they didn't like, you know, overplay it. I think it just, I went ahead and rewatched their goodbye scene after this episode again, which is in, season six when he decides to go back to the Iron Islands. And it's one of my favorite, you know, it comes like after Bran has like sworn fealty to Sansa, right, in the snow. And it's this like big emotional thing. That scene has always been great. And is of course mirrored in this episode, but like what always got me was Sansa saying goodbye to Theon, because Sophie Turner does this like one of her best pieces of acting, because Theon's like, you know, basically implying that he's going to leave. And she does this like weird, like half cry breath caught in her throat thing where she's like, you're not coming with us. But it's more subtle than that, because I'm not an actress, so like, you know, it's better
Don't
than what I just did but like and then she hugs him and she gives him this teary goodbye, and it's just sort of like Sansa has sort of like latched onto him in a way that you know, the show didn't have a spend a lot of time with, but like feels right to me. And so there was a lot going on with Sansa in this episode that like, I don't really like the idea that like, you know, women should smile more, women should be softer and more emotional for us to be on their side. But there was a lot of stuff happening in this episode with Sansa that like made me feel happier about being her side when she was icier and more austere, in terms of like, when Brienne goes up to testify for Jaime, and I think you really see Sansa's face like really soften in a way that feels meaningful. And I don't know, just all the notes that she's playing, and the fact that Sansa chose to share her last meal with Theon, I for some reason just like really, really hit me. And it's all probably to make me care about Theon before he dies, but it worked. So, you know, when you can see yourself being manipulated and you just sort of like let yourself be manipulated anyway, you know?
Totally. I mean, and I also like, there are a lot of times where I'm like, oh, like that's manipulative or this is whatever. And it's like, well, Richard, what do you think like drama is? Like what do you think like storytelling is? Like, sure.
Yeah.
Like, it's partly the job of the people telling the story to like get you to care. Like that's not. If that's manipulative, then the whole thing is, you know? So I should maybe let my sort of, I don't know, it's not my critical eye exactly, but it's my sort of, you know, cynical eye kind of, I need to just like watch the show and watch things like this and just let myself feel them more purely, than I maybe do.
That's not our job, right? Like, well, I don't know. It depends. They're, you know.
Well, it's like a funny thing because I am both watching this show, you know, as a work assignment to an extent. I mean, it doesn't feel like an assignment to talk about the show with you, but like, you know what I mean? It's part of our job, but also I'm watching as a fan. So kind of, and you're experiencing a similar thing where like balancing those two things can sometimes be a tricky arithmetic where I'll get really into something and it's like, wait, no, take a step back. What does this mean? You know, what do you really think about this? So it's that kind of push and pull that's been funny to observe the past two weeks.
Yeah. And trying to be both. You know, is sort of the goal, I think, because I think if you get too emotionally detached from art, then you're not like, you know, then you're like Bran and you're not experiencing it in a human way that people can relate to. And then if you get too swept up in your emotions or just like relax, enjoy it, then you're not providing the critical angle that some people like look for from us. So yeah, it's always walking that line. And with that like unexpected examination of our own roles in the culture, Richard.
Are we about to die? Oh God.
Is there anything else you want to talk about before we go?
You know, I'm nothing I want to talk about. I just want to make a plea that like maybe Brienne and Grey Worm could just be like, look, we know what's about to happen. So like, let's go sneak out the back and like, let the bad stuff happen to other people. Cause I don't know. I'm going to be really sad if what I think is going to happen happens.
Yeah. I think like, you know, what I would expect from a show like Game of Thrones, which, wants to surprise us and devastate us, is like, some of the things we happen are going to happen. And then I think on the other hand, we're going to be surprised by some of the people surviving. Does that make sense? Like,
totally.
I don't think they're going to hit every single person that we're like, oop, that person's going to die, but they're going to hit some and we're going to be like, ugh. All right. Well, with on that, on all those bummer sounds that I just made, let us go to our interview with Brian Cogman.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Thrilled to welcome back for the third time. I think you're now officially the third co-host of Still Watching, Brian Cogman.
Oh, wow. That's exciting.
I know.
I'm like one of those frequent Carson guests.
Yeah.
For all you kids out there that get that.
I get it. What a glow up for you.
Yeah. I'm like Charles Nelson Reilly. I'm really going.
Are you now. Yeah, anyway. You're like the center square or something like that. Anyway.
There it is. Yeah. I'm the center square.
All right. Well, Brian Cogman, congratulations on writing one of my favorite episodes of Game of Thrones again.
Yay. Thank you.
I've heard you told me a couple times sort of before it aired, and then you said it officially in Entertainment Weekly, so I think I can say it on air, that you consider this a love letter to the characters. Can you talk about what that means for you?
It really was. It was when we conceived the episode in the room, just the idea that we would really take the time to sit with all of these characters in Winterfell the night before the battle. When that sort of concept came up, I was delighted and eager to write it and ask the guys if I could write it because for lots of reasons, but that's the main one. It just felt like it was a chance for me who has had these characters sort of living in my heart for the last 10 years in some cases, a chance for me to really say goodbye to them and revisit some of the threads and arcs and kind of explore and take stock of where they all are. And in a weird way, I sort of took stock of where I was, you know, and so it was a lovely experience. It was the hardest experience. It was the hardest script by far of the 11 that I've had to write, without question. And the worst first draft I ever turned in. It was the worst first draft I ever turned in. I was terrified of it. The episode sort of terrified me. Because for practical reasons, it terrified me because it's not a story or a plot-driven episode necessarily. There's some plot stuff, obviously. You've got the rather large bombshell that John hits Danny with at the end of the episode, and you've got, you know, Jaime arriving and stuff with Sansa and Danny and all of that. So there's certainly some story, but it's essentially, though, it's the calm before the storm that you normally devote about 20 minutes to in a battle episode. We gave ourselves an hour. So it was just sort of nerve wracking to conceive scenes that weren't necessarily about a character getting from point A to point B. It was more about reflection and in some cases reunion. And so I was nervous about that just in general. And then what I ended up doing that first draft. So basically when I turn in a draft, the guys, the way they edit is the way they give notes is they just return the final draft document in, and they've just written in red in within the body of the document.
Right.
And I got, and I kind of knew, even when I turned it in, I thought, I don't feel great about this, but I didn't really know why. And sure enough, sure enough, when I got it back, the document was a sea of red. It was so basically, they were right. The problem was that the first draft of the episode was a Wikipedia page, essentially. It was the characters recapping the show for each other.
Right.
the impulse to write the scene came from a place of truth, because if you haven't seen somebody in 10 years, then not 10 years in this case, and if you haven't seen somebody in 2 years, you're going to let them know what you've been up to. But that doesn't make for particularly compelling drama. And so it was a lot of that. It was a lot of, you know, even that first scene with Jamie, you know, I had the original draft of Brienne's speech was essentially her relating here the entire storyline. And in great detail. Gwen could have made it watchable, but they encouraged me to find different ways in. So, and sure, there's a fair amount of information that has to be conveyed between characters anyway, and that certainly is there. But in almost every case, it was just about paring it down to the sort of core emotional state. And in some cases, in the case of the Shireen scene, it's a scene about Shireen where Shireen's never mentioned.
I loved that aspect of it.
Oh, good. And I hope it read. I wasn't sure. I thought, I hope people get it. And if they don't get it, it works as a scene anyway. But and I loved how Ramin worked in Shireen's song into four during the
he
scene.
Did.
Which
it's always some. It's oh, always that, somewhere I,
that was
under
a lovely
scene. Yeah,
surprise. Yeah, which I wrote. So that was a lovely surprise. But that scene is a perfect example. The first draft had a scene where Davos and Gilly, through a lot of really clunky screenwriting contrivance, somehow managed to figure out and discuss that they both used to be illiterate and were both taught to read by the same girl. And it was a perfectly fine scene, but the scene that we ended up coming up with and ended up resulting is, to me, much more powerful, because it is a scene about this character that meant a great deal to them, and neither of them knows. They're not aware of each other's connection to that child, and that the connection in the case of the literacy is specific. And I think there's something really beautiful about that, because there are threads that connect all of us that we will go our entire lives, in many cases, not knowing those connections. And so I thought there was something really beautiful about where the scene ended up, and ultimately, I think, more effective. Another example is, and this one hit very close to home, and this was actually a scene I never even put in the first draft. No one ever read it but me. I labored for about 2 weeks on a Theon Sansa scene that was essentially them talking about everything and everything that happened to them and Ramsay and all of it. And I didn't even end up turning it in. I just thought, you know what? We all were there. We all know what happened. They know what happened. They're the only people in the world, the two of them, that knows the extent of the abuse that happened to the other. And Sophie and Alfie are the kind of actors where you only need 4 seconds of them sharing a meal together and that embrace to get the weight of their connection and to be reminded of what they endured and how they've both come through it. And trying to contrive a scene where they process it in very knowing dialogue just felt like, it felt like a scene I was writing for the wrong reasons, if that makes sense. So I ended up never even turning that one in. I don't regret it, because I absolutely love the moments that they have in the episode. That's an example.
Me too. And there's so much of this episode that I love that is sort of unspoken but shared memory. And there is this theme throughout the episode. You know, like the crux of, at the middle of this episode, right, is you know, Bran baldly stating what the Night King's mission is, and like us being like, oh, okay, here it is. You know, but Sam then has this beautiful commentary about like what it means to be a human, and like memory makes us human, and we are what we remember, and that sort of stuff. And so the fact that you have these things like this shared Davos Gilly memory that they don't even speak, but exists as like sort of the fabric of the story, or this shared Theon Sansa memory that they don't have to talk about, but we know is there. I mean, it all just seems of this larger piece.
Yeah, it really ended up being, and that's what the episode was. And that's why I was really delighted that we took the time to do it. I think there was an expectation that we were just going to hit the ground running with spectacle right away. And so I was very pleased to be able to luxuriate in these characters. And also to take advantage of the sort of, there is something kind of funny and random about the assortment that has ended up together. And that was what that drinking scene really was about, was this sort of misfit group, some of whom have past relationships and some who only know each other a little bit, and many of whom have fought each other, and all of that kind of doesn't matter because the end is coming. And it was important to me to show these characters embracing their humanity and spending their last night, or what they, many of them believe could be their last night in the world, in grace. You know,
absolutely.
That was the key to that whole sequence. And it was a joy to write. That was maybe my favorite thing I've ever written on the show. That trio of scenes that builds up to the song.
Well, yeah. So I can tell from our own listenership numbers that there were a lot of people listening now who were not with us on our preseason journey to the final season of Game of Thrones. And so they didn't get to hear you talking about Kiss by Fire, which is one of my favorite episodes. But it seems like that episode you wrote from back in season 3 is so much a companion to this episode, in that there's like, you know, Shireen is introduced there. We get a Shireen call out here. You've got Beric and the Hound and Arya and Gendry in that episode. You've got Beric and the Hound and Arya and Gendry in this. And then of course, like the Jaime and Bran bathtub scene, which is just like one of my favorite things that's ever happened on Game of Thrones. And so, you know, is there a conscious effort to parallel that episode, or is this just coincidentally where we wound up at the end of it all?
I don't know how conscious it was. I mean, we when we were in the room, we certainly had rough ideas of things that we wanted to happen in the episode in terms of encounters and obviously the knighthood and all of that. But then the guys gave me a lot of freedom to shape it myself. I shaped it in the outline, in its outline form, in its infancy, which isn't always the case. Sometimes I will have written an episode that David or Dan or Dave or Vanessa back in the day actually broke the back of the structure, and then I would be assigned the script. But there are one or two where I was with it sort of the whole time. And so maybe just by virtue of the fact that it was me and I gravitate to a lot of these characters, that just sort of happened. I don't know. Because it also calls back, you know, as per the conversation a minute ago, it calls back to Theon and Sansa, of which, you know, I wrote the wedding night episode. And a lot of Sansa's stuff. So that threads through the Grey Worm Missandei stuff. You know, I've written a lot of their key scenes. So, over the years. So in some ways it, and even Jaime and Tyrion, I had a lot of their, season 4 kind of jail cell, stuff where we really found, I think, their relationship as brothers, because you only really saw them as brothers for the first couple episodes of the series, and then they were separated. So season 4 was when we really explored why they have the connection they have as brothers and why they have this deep love for each other. So even just having that little bit about them reflecting on their the perils of self-betterment, even that was sort of a callback to stuff that I had explored earlier, or been able to, you know, be the credited writer who explored. We obviously all did it together, but, so I don't know. That was the opportunity, I guess, that was afforded me in being assigned it. But it was, and then, yeah, and certainly Jaime and Brienne, I mean, and I've talked about this, like, I really love those characters. Jamie is one of my favorites. Brienne is as well. Gwen and Nikolai, I'm really fond of as people and as performers. So I was. It's funny, the scene for me, and the knighthood scene is the main reason I had to write the episode, right. Obviously. Yeah. I also really love the moment where I remember kind of happening upon this as I was writing it and being very moved even in the writing of it, just the idea of Jaime asking if he could serve under her command. That's as big a moment in many ways. He's never served under anyone, willingly. I mean, he served under whoever his Lord Commander was, but this is different. So that was a powerful thing to, and it was interesting, all of these moments, and this is very clear, and the guys really made this very clear in the writer's room, is they wanted these moments to sort of happen organically and not, like, she's not knighted on a hill by him with music soaring and the sun rising and cloaks billowing in the wind.
Right, yeah.
The guys were very adamant, you know, we knew that we were going to have her knighted by Jaime, but any staging of the scene in that way, they really pushed against. And so we came up together with this idea that it would just happen almost accidentally and turn into something solemn and ceremonial, you know, almost before anyone realizes what's happening. And there's a lovely little take, actually, and this is David Nutter. David Nutter, those scenes take so long to do because David Nutter shoots so much coverage, and it's so worth it. It's so worth it once you get in the editing room, because he's got so many looks to use from the different actors. And there's one beautiful moment that Peter has where you see Tyrion realize, oh my God, this is important. What's about to happen here? And I'm going to stand up and watch, because like the sort of historian and lover of people and culture and tradition in Tyrion is sort of stirred there, because he doesn't know Brienne. He has no real connection to her. He knows that she's the woman that saved his brother's life and vice versa. And he understands the connection that Jaime has with her, but he doesn't really know her. And he's sort of swept up in that moment as well. But then you get these looks from Pod, these wonderful things. David cuts to these amazing little moments, like when she looks at him and he sort of nods. He understands before she does that this is the real deal and this is important.
It felt like he was giving her, you know, permission to like want this. Like, it's okay. You can do this.
That's absolutely what it was. It's okay. Yeah. It's okay that you wanted this, and it's okay, you know, to be, and that's lovely. And when he, and then again, this is all in the editing and the beautiful post-production work. But when he says, "In the name of the mother, I charge you to protect the innocent," it cuts to Pod, which is lovely. So I don't know. I think there's, and that's all, you know, that's Nutter. I mean, he couldn't have been the more perfect director to be paired with the script, because the actors feel very safe with him and feel very supported, and he creates wonderful working environment, and we really, really takes the time and to hone in on all these little details. And so and it was one of the first episodes we shot in the shooting schedule, so it was and that sequence, I believe, we shot pretty much in sequence too, which helped.
I was talking to Gwendolyn recently about you, and she said this. She said, "I felt Brian had a real understanding of the trials the character had to overcome in life in order to achieve a sense of self-worth, and how far sometimes we have to travel to move the narrative society has subscribed to us. I think he helped establish the universal nature of the character in the writing with that knowledge." So I wanted to,
that's incredible.
I want to talk to you about like what Brienne means, and also not in a purient way. I hope in the best way possible. I interpret this scene as like a sex scene between Jaime and Brienne, not in like a it's just the connection is so strong. The fact that they forget anyone else is there in the room with them, and the fact that their connection has been so intense, you know.
There's great love there. I mean, there's just great love. And I think this episode is about them finally acknowledging, if not to each other, then to themselves, that there is love there, you know.
Yeah.
However you want to define that term. I almost leave up to the viewer, but there's a letting down of walls, you know, and Jamie is funnily the one who does it first, you know? Well, no, I guess she does it first because she vouches for him, but that's, you know, that's something that is also part of her, you know, chivalrous nature. But I think there's just little, it's a chipping away that happens kind of through over the course of the episode. And then, yeah, culminates in that moment. That's an amazing thing that Gwen said. I don't know. I've talked about this. I've always gravitated on the show to the either kind of messy, flawed, complicated. I mean, everybody's messy and flawed and complicated on the show, but the ones that get pulled back and forth and like Jamie or Sansa, or Theon, but also the ones that are the truly vulnerable, characters that aren't given much of a chance in life that, or you wouldn't think would have much of a chance in life that rise up. And certainly Brienne is one of them. Sam is another character like that. So yeah, it was important to me to be able to get in the muck with this scene and work it out.
I often find that I'm surprised by whatever the quote unquote internet chatter is around an episode. Cause I watch it with my, I'm too far deep into this show perspective. And then I'm like, oh, this is what everyone wants to talk about. And for some reason, everyone wants to talk about, the Arya and Gendry sex scene this morning. And there are a lot of opinions on it. About like Arya's age or Maisie's age or whether you're comfortable seeing a girl that you watched grow up like become a sexual being, and something I said to Richard earlier on this episode was like,
I hope none of those people ever have kids.
I know. I'm like, your daughter will become a sexual being eventually. I was just wondering if you could talk about this this scene and sort of like what you guys wanted from it.
Yeah, well, she's a human being. And I think what's so delightful about Arya's journey this season, and it's obviously not over yet, but in terms of this episode, you know, she's been so focused on one thing for so long, which is vengeance and almost forgetting herself and forgetting what it is to be a human. I mean, that was very much what the time at the Faceless Man was about, erasing humanity. And this is her, and also facing with what she think might be her imminent demise. It's like, I want to be a human being. I want to be a young woman. I want to experience this stuff, and I want to experience it on my terms. And she drives the scene. That was what was exciting for me about writing it. And I think for Maisie is that it's she drives that scene. It is Gendry's more than happy to go along with it, but it's on her terms. But at the same time, and I this is something I very specifically put in the script, and I thought David shot it beautifully. The shot is gorgeous. Same time he sees those scars, you know, he has that moment where he thinks, oh wow, what's happened here? This is not the person that he knew. And in many ways that was what's been attractive about her here, because she has changed, but there's that darkness too. But, you know, she's a young woman. She's a teenager. I mean, obviously the passage of time is murky on the show for lots of reasons. I mean, Tommen grew up really fast from one season to another. So trying to figure out the exact age of what Arya is, I think, is foolhardy. But I mean, look, I mean, teenagers have sex, guys. Hate to break it to you.
It's a fun fact.
So, and the actress is 22, but I mean, even it's like, this is human behavior. And faced with, that was the thing when we were plotting out the episode, and talking about it, it's like, what would these people on the last night of their, you know, how do you spend what you think might be the last night on Earth? And, that's certainly a valid option for your last night on Earth. So, I think it's a beautiful scene. I think it's a lot of fun and beautifully played by the two of them, and you know, yeah, you, when you first started watching the show, she was a kid, but she's not a kid anymore.
So, okay. So, I don't know. Well, to that end, I know that you've cautioned me elsewhere to not like, or cautioned people to maybe not get too, too in the weeds in terms of, I don't know, symbolism and metaphysical kind of Lost-esque analysis of the show, but I'm working on this thesis, so indulge me if you will, that that Winterfell represents this sort of way station, this sort of like reckoning, this, as you said, like sort of access to grace right before death. Like if death is represented by the Night King and they're headed to death, then this is like Winterfell becomes this place where all the like sins and the virtues are weighed and balanced and sort of attempt to be like righted. And also this idea that like when the Starks come home, and I'm talking about Jon and Theon and Sansa and Arya, and Bran, when they come home, they start to access more of their Starkishness, their humanity, because like these walls that you were talking about, these walls that they've thrown up, they can let them down a bit when they're inside the walls of Winterfell and around each other. Do you know what I mean? So like,
that's a beautiful, I think that's a beautiful analysis. I won't pretend that that was something that we
intended,
stated out loud. Do you know what I mean? That's not how the guys write. Which is frankly why I think they're good writers. I think, there are plenty of good writers that pick up that come up with a theme first, and then, but I think the guys, it's really more acting on instinct and just following what the characters will do and letting the story take its natural course. So yes, I think that's all true. I think there was definitely a discussion of the idea that there is a cyclical nature and that we started at Winterfell and we're gonna you know, begin the end game at Winterfell. But so that was a conscious choice, obviously, but I love that, actually. I think subconsciously I'm sure that's what we were doing, because it's true. When the three Stark siblings are back together in their home, there is a change, and the fact that these characters that have no business being in Winterfell are growing and changing within Winterfell. And because Winterfell the central sort of inciting incident of the show was this family from this good, honest place.
Yeah.
This place that is, if King's Landing is a nest of vipers, Winterfell is pure, you know? Which is why when Winterfell was perverted by those fuckers, the Boltons over those seasons, it hurt. And the whole idea of putting Sansa into that storyline, that was the idea behind it, was that that something good is being nightmarishly perverted. Right. And we wanted to have one of the actual Starks in there experiencing that, as horrific as it was to experience for the audience. That was the impetus behind that plot line. And so, yes, it speaks to that. It's that this is where it all started, and this is where the first men were, and this is where even the mythology of the whole show in some ways began, is the North. And all these characters that, like Tyrion and Jaime, like Tyrion keeps bringing it up. Like, it's hilarious that we're at Winterfell because we don't belong here. But they do, you know, everyone that is there does belong there. I think that was that was another point of the drinking scene, is that everything that's happened, it's brought everybody here. And what happens from here on out, who knows, but we're here together tonight. And that's why I love the lyric. I think it might have been Dan who finished the lyrics for Jenny of Old Stones. I wrote in my draft lyrics forthcoming, fully intending to write the lyric. And then I get my notes back and he'd written the damn lyric.
Oh.
I think he wanted the ASCAP residuals. But because I wrote the Shireen song lyrics, and I get a nice little check every once in a while. It's lovely. But I know, bummer, right? And of course, the machine covers it. But it was great. His lyrics were beautiful, and I think the never wanting to leave refrain. Yeah. I love that in how it relates to that scene. And Tyrion not wanting to split up. He wants that kind of fellowship. Maybe one last time. Do you know? And then the heartbreak of the whole episode is that it ends with these two characters who had come together and had finally found some peace together, and it being possibly ripped apart by this information
John
that Jon has to share with her. Yeah, you know, I think it ends on this sort of melancholic note that is appropriate as well, because it is Game of Thrones. And that's a scene that was a very tough scene to write. And the guys had a big hand. I mean, they always have a big hand in all the episodes and all the writing, but that was a scene that was hard for me to crack, that they really figured out a lot of by the end. Because again, it's information that we, the audience, knows. Week before we saw someone. Yeah. And the week before we saw the same information conveyed to John. So how do you make the scene feel different? How do you make, and my original draft, same thing. My original draft had them really having it out, talking all about it and all the ramifications. And again, it's distilling it to the simple moments, and the rather upsetting moment where, at the end, where the first thing she says is, "That means you have a claim to the throne," and then you see the look on John's face at hearing that, and then that horn blows. That's all you need, you know.
Yeah.
and if I've learned anything, I've learned so much, but if I've learned anything from the guys over the years, it's the idea of brevity, the idea of surgically finding just the key beats and weeding out the extraneous stuff. And anyway, so that turned out really well. I think the whole episode turned out well. I'm really very pleased with it. It's a nice one to end this decade journey with, because it feels like the kind of episode that I was good at writing. And I enjoyed writing most, you know.
Can I ask you nice. Like three super fast questions before you go?
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Of course.
Number one, are we supposed to, like, my hope is that we're supposed to just believe what Bran says about the Night King, about his mission, about the Three-Eyed Raven, about everything. Like, what Bran is mm-hmm. saying is true, right?
Well, I don't, you know, Bran has said what he has said. That's all I can really, I thought I would say.
How annoying. All right. And then, I'm sure this answer is going to be equally annoying. What, do you think Bran and Tyrion talked about when the camera cut away from them?
Oh, interesting. I know what they talked about, but probably should, abstain. I mean, you know, Tyrion wanted to hear, I think he wanted to hear more about his journey. I think he finds him intriguing and I wanted to, it's basically it's basically what it says. I'd like to hear more. I'd like to hear more about everything that happened, you know? So
there's nothing like,
they had a good
there's
talk.
Nothing crazy that happened off camera that we're going to like cut back to later. And it's like, actually Bran told me this or anything like that. That's not Game of Thrones style anyway.
I don't know. I don't know. They still got four episodes.
Irritating. All right. Here's my last question for you. This one will be easier. Was that a direct West Side Story, Stephen Sondheim reference when Grey Worm tells Missandei he'll take her there to the Isle of Noth?
Oh, wow. You mean like from like somewhere or something? Uh-huh. Or?
Yeah.
Oh. Hold my hand, it'll take you there. Oh, that's amazing. I wish I could say yes, but no. Again, probably subconscious. I mean, there's probably a lot of subconscious Sondheim stuff, if we're being honest, throughout. I mean, if I'm really... No. Although I did do a subconscious, and I didn't mean to do this, I did steal a line from A Christmas Story. And I didn't realize it until this past Christmas when I was watching A Christmas Story, and I realized I stole the line.
What line did you steal?
You know what it is? It's when... Tyrion says, "You want some of this piss? It's not bad. It's not good either." And then I watched A Christmas Story, which I've seen thousands of times. And at the end of the movie, Darren McGavin, the dad, is drinking some wine with his after they've opened the presents, and he goes, pretty good wine. Or Tannis had this wine. It's not bad. It's not good either." and I'm like, "Oh no!
Oh no! It's in my head.
I cribbed from A Christmas Story. I was so proud of that line."
That's amazing.
But, you know, it's fine. It's not the only time someone could say that in life, so I think we're okay. Well, not a conscious choice to pay homage to West Side Story, but I'll take it.
Why not? Let's make them the Romeo and Juliet of Winterfell. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, for your work on the show. It was amazing. I love this episode.
Well, thanks.
Thanks for talking.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
That is it for our discussion of Season 8, Episode 2, A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, which is also called Game of Thrones 69 for a while, because it's the 69th episode mm-hmm. before they released what the title was, and I am deeply mature. Anyway, Richard, where can people find you before next week?
I don't know, skulking around a blacksmith shop trying to find my own Gendry or something? I don't know. But, you know, beyond that, they can find me on Twitter at Rylaws and on VF.com. Joanna, where will you be until the big battle?
You'll find me hiding in the crypts, which are absolutely safe, definitely fine. There's not a lot of dead bodies down there that could be resurrected by the Night King at any moment or anything like that. It'll be fine. I'll be there with Gilly and all the babies and stuff like that.
Yeah, we should have maybe talked about that. Like, they're like, oh, guys, you know what he can do, right? Did you think, like, there's a possibility that Rickon would come back as a zombie? Somebody I saw on Twitter or something, which would be crazy. But
welcome to the PS of this episode. Most of the bodies in the Witchfell crypts are just bones. And so that feels, you know, a bunch of people keep going like, what about the, you know, resurrection of Ned Stark, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, listen, they cut Ned's head off and then they like boiled his bones. So it's just a skeleton with no head. And that, do you know how emotionally unsatisfying it's going to be to watch some sort of like stupid CG skeleton chasing like Arya through the crypts or something like that without a head, and we're like, oop, that one's Ned, it's got no head, like that'll be stupid looking, you know?
Now I want to see that.
Whereas, I mean, maybe Littlefinger's down there if they forgot to burn him. They know that they didn't burn Rickon is down there because after the Battle of the Bastards, John was just like, put him in the crypts. So, you know, he's like he's been down there a couple years, I guess, or months. I don't know how time works in Game of Thrones, but, you know, Rickon's been down there for the least amount of time. So he's still got some meat on those Starkish bones. But yeah, this theory that the Night King will raise the Kings of Winterfell, the Kings of Winter, has been a theory. I just think that in practicality, it will look silly if a bunch of skeletons are chasing our heroes. That being said, do I believe that we will see undead versions of a lot of characters we like and know? Yes, because here's the fun idea of this particular battle episode of Game of Thrones. Every one of our faves that dies could be resurrected and turned into the enemy, and then maybe we have to watch them die again, this time killed by someone they love. This is the calculus that I've been playing all preseason. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember if we talked about this on this show, but like, Richard right now, pick a character that you like don't want to see die. Anyone?
I mean, Brienne.
Okay, Brienne. All right. So the calculus is this. So you don't want Brienne to die. Let's say she dies, and let's pick the most, like, the saddest way she could die. Dies defending Jaime, dies defending Pod. One of those two. She dies, she gets resurrected by the Night King, let's say. So she's an undead Brienne. That's heartbreaking in and of itself because, mm-hmm. like, you know, blah, blah. And then either Jaime or Pod has to kill her. Like, do the math on who's the saddest person, you know, living person to then have to kill her. So that's just something, that's a thought experiment I've been playing. Pick a fave, think about them dying, and then think about who it will hurt you the most to watch, have to, like, stab them through the eye.
And that's our cheery little prompt for you to think about before next week.
This episode was edited and produced by Dave Gonzalez, and we will see you next time.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency.
Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now